Hi, everybody. This is Liz Nord, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. To edit your own films or not to edit your own films? That is very often the question, especially for documentary filmmakers, where so much of the story is shaped in post-production. Critics of the method say that it's too hard to be objective on your own, and that films edited by their makers are often too long and self-indulgent. But there are plenty of good reasons why editing your own project might be the right solution for you. And to break them down, we delve into the methods of two filmmakers who've done just that. At the Camden International Film Festival last month, I spoke with two documentary makers who had films in the festival, Irene Lustig and Dominique Gagnon. Lustig's film is Yours in Sisterhood. It features all kinds of people from across America today addressing the camera to read aloud and share personal responses to letters written in the 1970s to the editor of Ms. Magazine, the country's first mainstream feminist magazine. Gagnon's film is Going South. It's his second in a series that's entirely reliant on the editing process, as it's fully constructed out of YouTube clips. At first, seemingly completely random, and eventually shaping the trajectory of several characters to explore the meaning of truth in the internet era. Both filmmakers share their processes and how they make the zillions of decisions that go into an edit on their own. So if you're considering whether or not to edit your own work, or if you just want to know how the mind of an editor works, definitely give the episode a listen. So for context, do you always edit your own work?
I do always edit my own work. And for me, I'm very attached to the idea of editing my own work. And it feels to me like so much of the thinking and decisions happen for me in the editing room. That's really where the film is made for me. But also for me, there's a huge, and I come from kind of an experimental film background. So for me, so much of the process of figuring out what the materials emerge to be, happens through really like playing and experimenting and touching things in the editing room and moving things around myself. So to me, it feels really central to filmmaking to actually be the one who's in the, not just in the editing room, but doing the editing.
Okay, so I'm kind of the same. I've always been editing my films. Even in the, like 20 years ago, while I was shooting my own film and editing myself, most of the writing would happen on the editing table. Now that I use like found footage, it's barely all I do, editing. Often I don't even have an idea to start with. It starts with a cut and the other ones follows after. So for me, all the creative thinking, conceptualization, theorizing, because I like to explore subjects through it, research, everything happens in the editing room. And I'm so glad now, like, because when I started it, it was with Steenbeck, with film and scotch tapes. Now it's like I can do barely everything with my laptop, everything with the laptop. So it's part of my life. I edit every day. I nurture, I take care of my edit. And it's a really long process. Sometimes it takes a year or two to finalize the film. So it's a way of being with the material, occupying my film somehow, to have this power over it of editing.
That's an interesting point you make too, that, you know, back in the day we were editing with Steenbeck's and actual film, and that not only that has changed, but where you're finding your material, especially you, mm-hmm. Dominic, has totally changed. Interesting. We'll talk about how the industry has changed.
But the thing is that while I was making more traditional film, filming and editing and working with film, when I moved to a computer, it was no internet yet. You know, so a couple of years later, I bought my first PC. Then I had this called internet in my editing suit, you know, my editing room. So it became some sort of a distraction. You know, I would have to fight not looking at my emails while editing, chatting with my girlfriend, things like this, you know, watch porn. It's all kinds of distraction, you know. So I have decided to use it as source material instead of a distraction. So that's how I start to surf the web and edit clips.
Wow, so you leaned into the distraction of the
exactly,
internet.
Exactly.
I just wanted to add a thing about research, because you mentioned that also this idea where the research and conceptualization happens in editing. And that, I think, like, there's a big spectrum, I think, even in documentary, of how much people imagine they know their project before they begin. And I think the world of grant making and funding and pitching really encourages you to pretend you know what you're making before you know what you're making it. But I also, I don't know what I'm making until I'm editing it. And for me, that's so important. And, you know, when I start a film, it's not because there's a statement I want to make or a thing I want to do, right, but it's because I have a bunch of questions that feel like they're maybe interconnected or could be interconnected. And for me, it's really a curiosity that motivates me to, yeah, explore and spend time with stuff and sit with stuff and let the film emerge from whatever that stuff is. And all of that work happens for me in editing. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, the film changes so much. Like, maybe I write a thing for a grant where I pretend I know what it is, but I really don't know what it is at all until I'm with it every day and working with it in editing.
We've all done that weird grant pretending. Yeah, it's a strange part of the process.
But I often fall back on my shoes. Like, I will write a proposal, it's like a crazy idea, and then after I get the money, I do whatever I want. And to my surprise, often I just do exactly what I propose.
Really?
It happens
fascinating.
All the time. Huh. But it's not because I follow a map or anything. It's just that it starts with obsession most of the time for me. So I follow those obsessions and it leads me often where I started by writing a proposal or a grant. So I feel bad while I do it, but in the end, I'm okay.
So you're both editing alone. Does anyone else participate in the process? Do you have, like, people sitting in or advisors or?
It's really important to get feedback, especially when you're editing alone. I think you can get into a real, like, black hole of, like, you and yourself and your film. And my films are also long. My films are, like, 5 or 6 years usually, and the editing is very, very long. So I'm alone for years. So yeah, no one else is with me in the room when I'm editing, but then it's super important for me to, at certain moments, like, do rough cut screenings, and I have, like, a bunch of film friends whose aesthetics and opinions I really trust, and yeah, I think it's pretty important at certain points in the process to get feedback, but not every day. Like, I wouldn't want someone sitting there with me. Like, it's very personal and quirky and weird what I do alone in the editing room.
Yeah, I feel a bit bad about that because I work alone, of course, but and all my friends feel really privileged when I ask them to sit with me and to tell me all their ideas and comments, but I don't listen to them. It's just because I need them to sit through my film without touching it, to do a real playback. And I look at it through their eyes, but I don't care what they think. It might be insulted you're listening to me now, but it's totally opportunist, you know?
So what do you do in those sessions? Like, what do you get out of
watching
it? I would
drink beer.
But, like, what's the point for you of watching it with them and not taking their feedback?
Because I see them on their chair. I see them when they need to have a break, go to the bathroom. I see their reaction. Sometimes they can't hold it. Like, they have to say something. They talk to each other. And I feel the vibe of the film. Mm. But I don't need advice. I just need confirmation. So, and for me, like, when I'm alone, it's pure torture to say, I play back the film. It might be like a 2 hours and 30 minutes long edit, and I cannot see through it because I see a thing that I want to fix. I want to make a change. And then I lost the chronology. I lost the time. It's time-based. So if I spend 15 minutes to make a cut work, then I lost the timing of the film. So people helped me to sit through it and not intervening on it while it plays. So that's why I'd say it's a bit opportunistic. But it's always cool because after I can show them again 6 months later and then they can see the difference, and that's what I want to talk about. It's not their vision of my film, but the change I'm making. So they will always be the same people coming in my studio.
And I bet some of them take some credit. Like, oh, he made that change that I suggested, even though it really...
Yeah, I will. Often people are very bad, actually, at watching unfinished work. And I actually also experience that even if I send out a cut to people, often the advice they give me is wrong, and I know it's wrong. And it sounds arrogant or funny, but often... If someone says, like, oh, why don't you do this, or this doesn't really work, like, often it's something else that's not working. But I can kind of just really filter and interpret what I'm hearing. I think because I know so much how editing works, sometimes it's, like, not the thing they think that doesn't work, but it's the thing that is before it that's not working, or something about the context or time it takes to get to something. So, yeah, I also take feedback from people with a lot of, like, filtering and interpreting and trying to really understand what... Yeah, why is it not working? And it's often not the reason they're giving me for why something doesn't work.
Yeah, we give that advice to people a lot, too. It's like someone at a feedback screening might not have the answer, but the fact that if multiple people are sort of struggling with the same scene, then maybe that scene needs some more attention in some way, in your way.
But what I've noticed is that there's a big difference in showing a work in progress or a finished film. Because when you say it's not finished, do you want to look at it? Then it's fragile. It makes everything hyper fragile, you know, because they question everything. This should be shorter. They don't abandon themselves to your edit. They want to fix it. So it's really, that's why I don't listen to them so much, you know, because when I say it's finished and then they come, then they just have to take it. And I believe they don't see it the same way. They're not in a critical kind of analysis of it, but they just live it. Mm. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like we both sound like assholes, but I feel the same way, actually. I've had the experience of showing almost the same film to people as a rough cut and then as a finished film. And I get totally different feedback. But there's something about the social situation of when you're inviting feedback, or it's like you're setting up a kind of expectation of critical conversation. And then, yeah, people will hate everything in that conversation. And then you literally show the same thing and it's finished. And people respond very, very differently. Hmm. And yeah, I've had that experience a lot too.
Well, I want to get into a little bit of the process. We've sort of leapt ahead to when you already have something, which is, I think, very valuable for our listeners to hear about, too. Like, what do you do to shape this thing? But stepping way back, one thing that I thought about when thinking about this conversation, you know, folks who edit their own films, is that, so, you know, editing is decision-making. That's what you're doing all the time, making decisions. And so when you're making decisions by yourself, it's like a different kind of process, and I wanted to ask you about some of the specific decisions. So you kind of both got to this already, but I'm curious just how you decided, I am going to edit on my own, period. I'm not hiring someone, I'm not having an assistant.
I used to be an editor, so now I teach full-time now for my day job, but before that I was a freelance editor. And I always thought, I think even when I was studying film, editing was the thing that I loved and really responded to, and understood that that's the place where... And even when I was working as an editor, it felt the same. Like, it really felt like I was making so many creative and important decisions for the filmmaker that I was working for. And I know for some makers, that's a really generative and wonderful collaboration. But yeah, I was making so many decisions on those films that I was editing. So for me, it just came very naturally to edit my own work. Yeah.
To me, like, I totally, like, when I was at film school and I started editing, like, I totally fell in love with it. I had all kinds of classes, like cinematography, editing, blah, blah, blah. But that was the thing I really liked. And it brought me back to my souvenir as a kid, you know, like, what I was playing by myself. And it was a lot about collecting stuff. It could be, like, visit a show and take all the flyers and bring them back home and sort them by color, by texture, and that was my game. My games were made of editing projects somehow. And we would go to camping, and then I would start to collect shit and try to put them in groups and assemble them. And so when I laid my hand on a Steinbeck, I was just like, "Whoa, this is much better than Lego blocks." and then it was this. Still, after 25 years, is still the thing I like the most. I've been doing performance art, music, all kinds of things, but when it comes to editing, I like to organize things. I like to make sense out of things that make no sense. Mm. I like to measure what is immeasurable, you know, and editing allows me to do it.
Yeah, I had the same. I collect stuff too, and I loved making mixtapes in the tape era. Mixtapes, yeah. And I had a radio show in high school, like a little cassette recorder. I would just interview people and edit things with my 2-tape deck. So I think also when I found editing in my first film class in college, it was this experience where I just totally lost time and I could sit there for like 12 hours or all night and just like and it's a very different energy. Like I have friends who love shooting and I hate shooting. Shooting is all this incredibly, yeah, immersive, like being out in the world, responding very, very quickly to lots of things happening around you. And I love the kind of slow, immersive, thoughtful rhythm of just being alone in the editing room and trying things and thinking and yeah, just the way that it's slow and immersive for me is really pleasurable.
So, continuing on this decision thing, then you're in there, and all you're doing is making decisions all the time. So, how do you sort of gauge your decision making, even with something like selects? Like, how do you decide what material to use?
I watch everything. And I've made archival projects, and then this new film is stuff that I've shot and not archival, but I watch absolutely everything. I take notes on everything and I cut everything, so I'm not really making decisions about what to use and not use until I've made a pass at cutting all the material. And that's really important. Like that for me is really a process of knowing and learning what my footage might be. And I do a lot of writing and take notes and start to get ideas or see connections. But just putting that, it's a lot of time to watch everything and cut everything, but that time feels like really important to me.
Can you tell me a little more about like cutting everything in terms of if you shot like in this project and you have, you know, 100 hours, what does it mean to cut everything?
I mean, everything that I log everything and watch it and have a record of everything that there is. But everything that could be a scene, I cut into a scene. With archival stuff, it's different because it's not shooting in the same way. And with that, I work differently. Like with the previous film I made that was almost all archival, I was just making sketches. Like I was making hundreds of like 3 to 5 minute little sketches of trying to play with footage in different ways or put things together in different ways or gather together things that felt like they were in conversation about one idea. And I throw a lot of those away. But yeah, for me, it's really this excessive process of like lots more cutting than I could possibly need for the film and lots more watching and lots more logging, but really trying to move through the whole ecosystem of whatever my materials are, like before I'm trying to make a structure or imagine like how it starts and how it ends, that before that, there's just this big process of taking tons of formless stuff and reducing it into smaller pieces.
There are many ways of editing, but me, I break get down to two ways. You can go by addition or subtraction. And I work by subtraction. I don't like to think that this is my first shot, this is my second shot, and add them to a timeline. If I have 300 hours of footage, it happens sometimes in my production, I have big volume of images, then I will have a 300 hours long version of my film to start with.
I will discriminate
everything to the bone until I get something it's weave, you know, like it's like weaving. Some images like each other, so they end up side by side. And slowly I built up sequences. Those sequences find their place also. When I feel something is more like an ending or beginning of a film, a good intro or something, I will put it all in the beginning of the timeline. I move things around. And I somehow I see the film, I see like a sketch of the film, and I will find my first shot and put it in front. And but this one could work too, you know, and I wait until the rest develop so I can make a better decision on discriminating those two or three potential opening shots. And everything has to be communicating together, like to make it like connected, all to connected together. And that's what I like, because I have such like different material, and find solving the connecting joint, you know, like how can I connect this with this, and how you connect like a water slide video, and that will lead you to the space station, International Space Station, you know, and it can be a matter of movement, line, color, it can be anything, it can be the sound element, words, so how things connect together, and to try to make sense out of this mess I'm working with. Because if you think of it, like I work with a ratio of infinite to one dealing with the internet. So it's almost a nightmare for most editor. How do you deal with that? So I organize my time, like there's a time of capturing, and then after I disconnect myself completely from the internet. And the solution needs to come from the volume of images I have. I don't go back on the internet online to find a solution for my edit. It needs to be solved inside, in my intranet, you know? And for that, because it's really difficult to like pull off the plug, so I have a small cabin in the wood. There's no phone, no internet, no nothing.
Don't give yourself a choice.
And this is where I, you know, find my solution. Mm-hmm. It has to come from the material.
So it sounds like in a way you both use a like a reductive rather than an additive
process. Yeah, I do too, definitely.
But like, I'm curious just to follow up with Dominic. So when Irene has material, if it's not an archival project, she shot it and that's it. That's the material she has to work with. In your case, as you say, the internet is infinite, and if you're pulling material from the internet, like you're deciding what it is you're starting with. So in a way you're making selects before you've ever made selects in the editing process. So how do you make those?
Well, I would use like keywords, for example, like when I look for videos online. For example, now I want to try to make a film about China. You know, and there's this great firewall, and it's really difficult to have non-viral amateur videos that make sense. So it's like I will use certain keywords, you know, in search engine. And this is already editing, you know, it's already selecting, it's already discriminating stuff. So now I go by everything China, you know, boat China, tennis China, and then I go through all the words of the dictionary, you know, plus China, and then I see like I'm trying to see if I can do a portrait of China by exposing the filters, the censorship, that if I see only nice things, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, you know. So trying to make like a portrait by the negative, from what I can reach, what I cannot get, what is hidden. So it might do a really different film, and I'm completely embracing this idea of censorship and filters and firewalls and encryption and blockchain. And I'll see what it's going to completely influence the aesthetic of the film and the content and everything. But it's a matter of abandoning myself to super simple rules, you know. Use this keyword and that's it. So it becomes almost like scientific, you know, like a searcher, or I don't want to be so much involved like emotionally or aesthetically in it. I just grab everything. And when I'm offline, then I will try to find a subject, try to find a rhythm, try to find a climax to the film, even suspense. I like to play with gender, genre cinema, you know, like in documentary. So I like to create like really horrific situation, you know, by splicing certain visual with certain sound. And like in Going South, there's a scene where you see kids dancing in the discotheque, and then I've used like firework sound over it. So all the laser, like it's like killing robot, like want to kill all those kids in the discotheque. And to me, like it says so much about like this, I don't know, like latent violence there is in all those acts of like raves and all those kids like getting naked on drugs and alienating themselves with lasers and just jumping everywhere. And with those fireworks, it just hijacking a situation and make it something else, you know, hijacking some visual, some popular culture, chunk of popular culture and just transform it into something else.
So one of the critiques of people, of films that are edited by their maker, it can be, you know, it was too hard for them to kill their darlings. They left too much in because they didn't have an objective, you know, somebody else to say, you got to get rid of that thing as much as you love it. And you don't have those people. So how do you make, that you don't have, you know, someone standing over your shoulder by design saying, you must get rid of this, or this just is too much, or I know you love it, but it's not going to work. So how do you sort of police yourself in the edit room?
I'm so hard on my footage. Yeah, I don't think I need a police. Although I did read a review that said yours in Sisterhood is much too long. But I think people are not used to listening to women for 100 minutes. So I think that it feels long to people for that reason, honestly. Really, when I read it, I was like, yeah, it's a long time for women to speak on screen. Wow. So. But yeah, I'm very hard on myself. I really feel like I know when a film is done, and by the time I know it's done, I've watched it so many times and spent years usually just with the material, looking at the material. So yeah, it's never a question, and I cut a lot of stuff that I love, and that's not hard to do once you watch it enough times, you just know when it's not working. So that hasn't been a struggle. I don't know, maybe my work would be better if they were shorter. I don't know.
Yeah, it used to be problematic, I think, in my first film because I was shooting myself. So I would remember how hard it was to get some certain shots. But now, since I work with others, people, visuals, like, I'm super hard on everything. No strings attached, you know, like, it's just... It's what I see, you know, and I don't know the context of filming, the value of it, or I don't know the people. It's not like making a film about my family, or it's other people's family.
Right.
So I feel I'm quite okay, you know, and I really take it like, I always want to make things up to like next level, you know, like, so it's all about concentration. So sometimes it's just like I would spend 2-3 days just to remove a few frame out of the film. Because the shorter, the better. Because it would be more concentrated. But like the last one I did is 104 minutes. But I started with 500 hours of footage. Ooh. So in the end, like, you end up like trying to take out like one word, the end of a sentence, just for fluidity.
Right.
But to me, like, the shorter is the better all the time. I don't try to make long film, but now it just happened because I work with big volume. But yeah, some friends sometimes say, oh, you're obsessed with this and that, and it always come back and those things. And to me, it's totally fine. I'm an auteur, you know? I have my own obsession, my own thing, you know?
Yeah, what filmmaker isn't obsessed with something? I mean, you know, Irene, you're spending 5-6 years on a film. That's some level of obsession.
Yeah, and I had yours in Sisterhood was 300 people that I filmed with, and the film itself has 27 people in it. And it's very different from a lot of my last film was archival and much more essayistic and much more complicated in its structure. And this film, I think, looks very simple in the way that it's edited. Like, it's quite kind of formal and almost a structural film, and it's kind of durational and slow and long, but it's so present, like every second of like, how long is the right amount of time for this long thing to stay on screen, and when does it cut, and how does it cut? Like, yeah, all of that stuff is like so precisely worked out for that film, even though it feels simple and airy and durational. It's, yeah, equally precise, I think.
Nothing happened by accident.
Oh, no. Not a frame, no.
Actually, to your point, though, it is a non-traditional structure. Both of your films, the films we're talking about today, are non-traditional structures. And that was a decision you had to come to as well. So I'm curious sort of when in the process you had a sense of the structure you were going for, if that played out as you worked with material, and how did you kind of know that you could keep an audience with you on a journey that's not a traditional beginning, middle, end journey?
I mean, I never make beginning, middle, end journal. It's like not in a form that, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of played out, that beginning, middle, end journey. This film is easier, actually, than a lot of my other work. So it is an unconventional form, but actually a lot of the form comes out of the way it's shot, where it has this kind of, it's a kind of a series of performances and then documentary conversations that are mixed together. But it was, you know, all shot with just two lenses and one camera, and everyone was shot the same way. So it already coming into the edit had, like, a lot of the form was kind of worked through. And a lot of those decisions were very early. Like, I knew I didn't want to cut people up or cut them together in this film. It felt very important to make a lot of time and space around each interaction with each person and kind of really give people a generous screen time. Like, that film is really about listening in some ways. So a lot of the form came out of things I knew before I even started editing. So yeah, for this film, a lot of the decisions were like, how long is the right amount of long, and then which people and what order, and how does it produce different meanings with different choices around that. But also there was a moment where a lot of people were telling me to put archival footage or images into that film, because it is also about the 70s, and people know that I've made a lot of work with. And this film comes out of archival research. It's based on letters written in the 70s. But I felt pretty strongly with this film not to do that and to really withhold images from the past, because I think it's very easy to make a nostalgic space when people are thinking about, I don't know, the 70s. There's a lot of work about the 70s that's kind of nostalgic that's come out recently. And it felt important to me to kind of make a claim with this film that it's really about this unfinished business that's really being actively negotiated in the present. And I wanted to keep the film in the present, and that's what worked for this film, even though I love archival material and have made a lot of other work that's only archival. So those were some of the decisions that I made.
Me, really young, like as a student, there were a few filmmakers that said that cinema is dead. In the 90s, like, it was really like a big thing. And I said, okay, I'll take their word, you know, as a student. I said, I will find a corpse, you know. Where is it? And then I couldn't really find it, because you still see people make films, there are festivals. So I say, okay, so then it's because I don't find the corpse, it's being dismantled, you know? And then that was the right thinking, because everything has become cinematographic. Video clips, publicity, even the way we share content on Instagram, or how people like dress, and it's really cinematographic. So my work now is to find those bits, you know, like I find a hand there, I find a foot, I find an ear, and then stitch them back all together. Those elements of popular culture that are cinematographic, as cinema has been dissolved in popular culture, everybody makes his own cinema now, you know, YouTubers, blah, blah, blah. Even cops with body cam. You know, like, right. So there's cinema everywhere now, you know, tragedy, drama, comedy. So to me, it's find those little bits, you know, of cinema and stitch them together to have like this kind of Frankenstein cinema, you know. So my guideline to answer your question is, what makes it cinematographic? What makes it cinema again? You know, to stitch YouTubers, clips, video together and get something that is more like narrative, you know, having character development over times in the film, having suspense, not saying everything, which is really traditional for cinema. Mm-hmm. So I feel I'm using extremely traditional technique of telling a story or convince a point or whatever, but I use different material as a starting point. So this is the only thing that makes my film weird, because I feel I'm really classic. You know, the Going South is really classic. You have eight central characters and you follow them in their journey, and there are pause, interlude, some, you know, like drama tricks, and it makes it like a watchable film, you know? But you don't know the subject. You don't know where it's going. It's not like you're not being taken by the hand and walk through the film. It's disturbing because you don't know what's going on. You don't know what to expect next. But after 30 minutes of almost like chaos, then you start to feel a structure. And you see a character is coming back. Mm-hmm. And you feel that it's going to see him again and again and again. And then it becomes really classical form of storytelling.
Yeah, I can say another thing about story, which I've thought a lot about, because, again, in the funding world, I think there's so much interest in kind of emphasis, traditional story and emphasis on character and character arc. And for me, there's a lot of like politics around that question, especially in documentary. Like, what does it mean to seek out or cast like some one person who's holding in their body and life a social issue or a larger political situation? Like, I think it's very ethically problematic, actually, to make films that way. So yeah, in this film in particular, it was very important to me to make a collective film that's not about a character and not inviting one person to represent feminism or feminist conversation, and yeah, not find like some uplifting woman who's doing a great thing to tell a story about, but to really make a different kind of claim and different politics, like actually in the structure and form of how the film is about many people who don't agree with each other, who are, you know, speaking, creating a space of speaking and listening across a lot of difference. So yeah, I think there's also kind of a, yeah, politics around story form and what are the limitations of that ethically and politically.
I also think it's an exciting moment even to have the two of you here, you know, the boundaries of storytelling within doc and what that means and what you quote unquote have to do or don't have to do is really exploding in a nice way, I think, in a positive way.
I mean, it's nice that the work is getting shown. I think a lot, I mean, there's always been a huge experimental film community and all kinds of really interesting and formally innovative work, but I think it's just about what kind of profile that work gets and where it gets shown and who's paying attention.
Right.
But yeah, it's been amazing that this film has been showing a lot. I've made other work that doesn't show at this level. So it's not that the work hasn't always been there, but it's about what people are paying attention to and how the kind of big kind of uber conversation starts to shift in the documentary world. And I've seen a little bit of that in the past few years, and that is nice. Mm. But the work has been there all along. People have always been experimenting.
Well, back to the topic at hand. So now I just want a devil's advocate moment. Why shouldn't someone edit their own work? Like, what's bad about it?
I don't know, but I can only think of my friends, filmmakers' friends, like those who use others to edit. Most of the time, they'll do it because they know the person, they know the editor. Sometimes it's long time relationship, you know, you have your editor because it's your good friend, you can debrief, you can talk, it's almost like a psychologist. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about my friends, you know, but I think that doing it by themselves would be way too difficult in terms of anxiety. They couldn't like carry it. And they totally need their pal, their friend to take care of it, have some distance, you know, and some people are just really, really, really good at editing. They have this sense of cutting and timing, and you, I think you're born with that. It's not something you really learn. You can learn to do commercial or really like normal commercial. It's easy. You know, you just have to copy, but to invent things on the editing table, to make sense out of garbage sometimes, you know, like, or bad, really bad shoots, you know, like, you have to have a creative mind, you know, and being good at designing solutions for films. And this you cannot really learn. So some people just don't have it. They have good skills on the ground, like meeting people, filming, everything, financing, pitching. But they need it because it can really make the difference. Like a badly edited film is the saddest thing in the world. Mm-hmm. When you watch a film and you feel like you would re-edit it yourself to make it super powerful, it's really sad.
Yeah, and I think to pick up on that, it is actually psychologically, it's hard to work alone and even... Yeah, you have to be very strong to, I think, wake up every morning and just the act of imagination to tell yourself that you know, that you're a filmmaker, that your project is real, that this thing that you're doing is important or matters or is meaningful. Yeah, that's not for everyone, I think, to just invent that psychological universe for themselves day after day. and it's not always easy for me. It's gotten easier the more the world also believes that I'm a filmmaker and making real things, it makes it easier. Certainly when I was young, like in my 20s, that was like just exhausting to every day be like, I'm making this like feature film alone. But yeah, I think for a lot of people, just being in a collaborative community just helps them, work feel real even before it's out in the world and is real.
Well, then a final question is, if folks have heard this conversation, they say, you know what, I'm going to embark on my next one on my own. I think these folks are on to something. How would you advise them? Would you have any advice about process or getting psychologically ready or why, you know, how to approach their project?
I think just watch everything a lot. I think because people want to skip to like knowing what the film will be before they know the material, but really just learning what you have for as long as it takes to learn that before you try to make a structure. And I love index cards. That's very specific advice. But actually, the cabin without internet, like for me, it's really important in a certain moment to just get out of the computer, because there's that space of nonlinear editors. You can just infinitely move stuff around and tweak and like you can kind of never see your whole film because eventually it's all these tiny little like slivers of shots on a timeline. But just to have ways of just even more analog, very low-tech ways of getting outside of that nonlinear editing world to just think about what the pieces of your film are and how they might form a structure. I just use colored index cards, but that's my advice.
My first advice would be to buy a really good chair, because going to spend a lot of time sitting and watching and editing. So honestly, like, it makes the difference. I've been sitting on shitty chair all my life, and now I have one, a good one. I own it. But the second thing would be to insist with everybody, post-production facilities, everything. Insist on having the freedom to work sound and visual at the same time. You don't edit visual and after you do the sound editing or the sound design, that is not an option anymore. This is working method that belongs to film, where it was really complicated to handle the two medium at the same time because you had magnetic sound and celluloid visuals. It couldn't be mixed together easily. So most post-production center now still work this way. You know, you do your offline, you do your online, you do your sound design, and after, if you want to fix something with the visual with the sound, you cannot. If you want to fix something with the sound with the visual, you cannot. And I think this is our opportunity now with computers to have everything digital. Sound and images for me is the same. It's digital, and it can be tweaked all together. So insist, then make pressure on every center, production center, to allow you to work the both together. You never lock your picture before starting to do sound or anything. You keep it open. That would be my advice.
Yeah, I would just add to that. My last film, I worked for 2.5 years with my sound designer, and she gave me her whole sound library very early in the process, and the difference it made to be editing with sound design all along. Because it totally changes the tone of the film and the way that meaning is produced. And I think that's really good advice, is to work with sound as early as possible.
What a luxury. Well, I'm so excited to hear, you know, what's going to happen, who listens to this podcast and makes the decision. You have definitely influenced some folks today, I think. So thank you so much for your time and all your insights and wisdom.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dominic and Irene, and thank you for listening. Both of their current films are still on the festival circuit, so look out for their releases in the coming year. If you liked this conversation, come back for a new interview or roundtable every Monday. And on Thursdays, don't miss our Indie Film Weekly news show that fills you in on everything you might have missed when you were busy making films. You can get any of these by searching for the No Film School podcast in iTunes or your favorite app. Also, be sure to visit nofilmschool.com for useful new filmmaking articles every single day. Meanwhile, stay in touch. You can reach me on Twitter @LizFilm, and we are on Twitter @NoFilmSchool. See you on Thursday.